Yeah, we'll make a start. So the title is, Was Marx Ever a Leninist? Yeah, thank you.
Okay. There was some confusion over what the title was, because it was once advertised as, Was Lenin Ever a Marxist? Which, of course, is a different question, which would have a different answer. But anyway, I suppose you could say it's a silly question, since Lenin was only 13 when Marx died in 1883, and the two never met. But Lenin considered himself to be a Marxist and saw nothing incompatible between Marx's views and his own view that a minority vanguard party could seize power in the course of a bourgeois revolution and turn it into a socialist revolution. Indeed, he probably sincerely believed that this was Marx's view. Now, if this is the case, if Lenin really did sincerely believe it, it means he didn't simply make things up. It implies that there must have been something there for him to distort, some at least superficially plausible basis for him not to see it as a distortion. Now, after Marx became a socialist in 1843, he was politically active in the sense of being involved in politics as a member of an organization for two periods of his life, from 1846 to 1852, and from 1864 to 1873, but under two quite different political conditions. In the 1840s, Germany had yet to undergo its bourgeois revolution. It was a revolution that would bring the capitalist class, the factory owners and merchants, to power in place of a semi-feudal landed aristocracy and an absolutist monarch. While in the 1860s, Marx in Britain was working with British and other trade unionists and political activists interested in running what amounted to a trade union, not to say, in fact, reformist international. Lenin, naturally, since conditions in Tsarist Russia were more akin to 1840s Germany than 1860s Europe, was more interested in Marx's first period of political activity, when Marx was a socialist active in the pre-bourgeois revolutionary situation. Now, most of Marx's writings from this period, including the Communist Manifesto, were concerned with the tactics socialists should adopt in the course of a bourgeois revolution. Maybe I should explain at this point. I'm going to be using terms which we don't normally use. Bourgeoisie, petty bourgeoisie, proletariat. But these were words which Marx and revolutionaries at the time did employ. Now, Marx's basic position was that socialists, or communists, as most socialists, including Marx, then called themselves, should support the struggle of the bourgeoisie to win political power from absolutist rulers, and should act as its extreme left wing, advocating a democratic republic rather than the constitutional monarchy advocated by the moderates. But he went on to say that after the bourgeoisie had come to power, socialists should urge the workers to wage a political class struggle against them to begin, in other words, their own struggle for political power. Now, Marx adhered to this position fairly strictly, even to the extent of criticizing those socialists who argued either that workers should oppose the bourgeoisie politically, even before the latter had won political control, or that workers should ignore politics and should concentrate on the economic struggles leading the capitalists to fight their own political battles. So we can say that for the period beginning 1848 to the middle of 1850, Marx believed that there was a real possibility that the German bourgeois revolution could in fact be turned into a proletarian revolution, as a revolution in which the proletariat came to control political power. Now, proletarian revolution is not a term we normally use. It is not to be understood as meaning the same thing as a socialist revolution, which was a revolution that would directly lead to the establishment of socialism. Marx used it to mean a political revolution that would bring the proletariat into control of political power. I mean, as for instance, he said happened in the Paris Commune of 1871, and for a brief period of insurrection in Paris in June 1848. I mean, Marx knew perfectly well that in the conditions prevailing in 1848, the immediate establishment of socialism and communism was impossible. but he believed that some inroads into capitalist property rights and conditions of production could be made and gradually extended. I mean, this, of course, meant that he was committed to the concept of a more or less lengthy transition period of proletarian rule, which, of course, is something that Lenin latched onto. It is from some of Marx's writings from this period that Lenin was able to convince himself that his tactics in 1917 had some basis in Marx. In the Communist Manifesto itself advances a view that the coming bourgeois revolution in Germany would be rapidly followed by a proletarian revolution. And the actual title of the manifesto was the Manifesto of the Communist Party. Of course, it had nothing to do with the parties which, after 1917, called themselves the Communist Party in most countries in the world. In 1848, the word party was not yet understood in its modern sense of an organization of its own structure and membership. At that time, it simply meant a current of opinion, and this was the sense it was meant in the title. And it should be party with a small p, but of course in German, all nouns begin with a capital. Actually, today, the title under which it is generally known as the Communist Manifesto conveys the meaning more accurately than its actual title of the Manifesto of the Communist Party. But having said this, the manifesto was in fact that of a specific organization, the Communist League of Germany, of which Marx and Engels were members. Now, Marx's views on what was like to happen in Germany and what socialists there should do stated right at the end of the Communist Manifesto. So I'll read this passage from the Communist Manifesto. The communists turn their attention chiefly to Germany, because that country is on the eve of a bourgeois revolution. It is bound to be carried out under more advanced conditions of European civilization and with a much more developed proletariat than of England was in the 17th and of France in the 18th century, and because the bourgeois revolution in Germany will be but the prelude to an immediately following proletarian revolution. Now, Marx and the Communist League soon had a chance to test this theory that the bourgeois revolution in Germany will be a prelude immediately following proletarian revolution. In February 1848, a revolution in Paris overthrew the king and established a democratic republic. In March, street battles broke out in Berlin, Vienna, and Milan, which was then ruled by Austria. In Berlin, the King of Prussia was forced to allow the election of a National Assembly to draw up a constitution, I mean, the first step towards turning Prussia into a constitutional monarchy. At the time of the February Revolution in France, Marx was in Brussels, but was soon expelled to France, where he had lived before and for a while, and where he was welcomed back with honours as Citizen Marx. With the outbreak of the German Revolution in March, Marx moved to Germany, but not to Berlin, the capital, but to Cologne in the Rhineland. There were two reasons for this choice. One was that as the Rhineland had been occupied by Napoleon's troops, feudalism had been abolished there, and the Napoleonic Code was enforced as the basic law, which allowed more freedom of organization and the press than in Prussia proper, even though Rhineland formed part of the Kingdom of Prussia. I mean, this is, in fact, the only reason, you know, people have written books calling Marx the Red Prussian, but he wasn't, in fact, a Prussian, except technically. The second reason was that Marx had been politically active there before. In 1842 and 1843, he'd been editor of a Cologne paper, the Rheinische Zeitung, or the Rheinische Gazette. That was before he became a socialist and was still merely a Republican Democrat. But even democratic views were too much for the Prussian authorities, and Marx left for France, where he met Parisian workers and completed his conversion to socialist ideas. So incidentally, refuting another of Lenin's views that socialist ideas had to first be brought to the workers by the bourgeois intellectuals. In fact, it was the other way around. It was Marx, the bourgeois intellectual, learned his socialist ideas from German and French workers in Paris. And when he returned to Cologne in 1848, Marx's idea was to revive the Rheinische Zeitung as a daily paper to be called the New Rheinische Gazette, to agitate for democracy, in other words, for a democratic republic, not for socialism specifically. The subtitle of the paper, the first issue appeared in June 1848, was precisely Organ of Democracy. This was in accordance with Marx's general political position that socialists should first help the bourgeoisie destroy absolutism and feudalism before beginning the political struggle against them. So in practice, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung acted as the voice of the extreme left wing or the radical section of the bourgeoisie. As editor, much of Marx's time was taken up with the routine task of bringing out a daily paper, and many, most of the articles were written by Engels and later mistakenly, in fact, attributed to Marx. Engels later explained that though the members of the Communist League knew what was going on in Germany in 1848 and 1849 was essentially a bourgeois revolution, the only model was the French Revolution, particularly the period 1793 to 94, when Robespierre and the Jacobins were in power. There had in fact been two revolutions in France. The first in 1789, which with the storming of the Bastille was the establishment of a constitutional monarchy, and the second in 1792, which eventually led to the establishment of a republic, the execution of the king, and the waging of a revolutionary anti-feudal war against the absolutist states of Europe. Engels, in his articles, called for the German bourgeois revolution to follow the same course as the French Revolution and move on from the constitutional monarchy stage to the more radical stage of dictatorship, terror, and revolutionary war. But Engels was calling for a strong centralized government that would use terror against the overruling classes and their supporters and wage a revolutionary war against Russia, can be seen from the following quotes. This is what he wrote in September 1848. Every state which finds itself in a provisional situation after a revolution requires a dictator, an energetic dictator at that. And then in November, there's only one way of shortening, simplifying, and concentrating the murderous death pangs of the old society, the bloody birth pangs of the new. Only one way, revolutionary terrorism. And then in February 1849, hatred of the Russians was and still is the first revolutionary passion of the Germans. We can only secure the revolution against these Slav peoples by the most decisive acts of terrorism. Now, it's not clear precisely what acts of terrorism Engels had in mind for the Czechs and the Krauts. It's probably as well not to ask. I mean, to a socialist today, such views are unacceptable, even shocking. Engels himself later downplayed their significance, attributing them to an erroneous assessment of the conditions of the time. But they were, of course, music to Lenin's ears and provided a superficial justification for his own practice after 1917 of dictatorship and terror. One thing Lenin ignored, however, was that Engels was talking about what should happen in the course of a bourgeois revolution, not about what should happen during a proletarian revolution. He and Marx had already developed a theory of the significance of terror during a bourgeois revolution as something necessary to wipe out feudalism, but which, because the bourgeoisie was too timid to do it itself, fell to other more radical groups within society. In an article written in October 1847, for instance, Marx had written, I'm quoting again, "The terror in France could thus, by its mighty hammer blows, only serve to spirit away, as it were, the ruins of feudalism from French soil. The timidly considerate bourgeoisie would not have accomplished this task for decades. The bloody action of the people thus only prepared the way for it." That's the way for the bourgeoisie. Engels said more or less the same thing in one of the articles in the New Rheinische Zeitung in December 1848, where in the course of the bourgeois revolution, he wrote, "the proletariat and other sections of the town population, which did not form part of the bourgeoisie," so where that group stood in opposition to the bourgeoisie, as, for example, in 1793 and 1794 in France, they were in fact fighting for the implementation of the interests of the bourgeoisie, although not in the manner of the bourgeoisie. The whole of the French terror was nothing other than the plebeian manner of dealing with the enemies of the bourgeoisie, with absolutism, feudalism, and parochialism. Now, this didn't mean that Marx, and particularly Engels, didn't support such decisive actions against feudalism and the old ruling class and their supporters. But I saw this as a necessary stage through which a bourgeois revolution had to pass if it was to deal decisively with feudalism and clear the way for the free development of capitalism, and so for the proletariat to be in a position to wage its political class struggle against the bourgeoisie. It does, however, provide some clues as to how they thought a bourgeois revolution might develop into a proletarian revolution. Engels, writing nearly 50 years later, in 1895, this is in his introduction to a re-edition of some of Marx's writings from the period called The Class Struggles in France. Engels suggested that what a revolutionary socialist like himself had thought at the time was that whereas in 1794 the bourgeoisie had got rid of the radicals once they'd done the dirty work of eliminating feudalism and its supporters for them, in 1848 it would be different. Socialists could get the proletariat to push the revolution even further and turn it from a minority bourgeois revolution, which it would have been even in its radical phase, into a majority proletarian revolution. Now, two reasons were given for supposing that the outcome in 1848 could be different than from what it had been in 1794, both of which were mentioned in that quote I gave from the Communist Manifesto. One was the existence of a more developed and politically advanced working class. The other was the presence and intervention of revolutionary socialists who understood what was going on. But we don't need to rely just on Engels' reminiscences of 47 years later. There exists a document drafted by Marx on behalf of the Central Committee of the Communist League and known as the Address of the Central Committee to the Communist League, March 1850, which is explicit enough. It says, the German bourgeois revolution had not succeeded. On the contrary, in November 1848, the counter-revolution had won a decisive victory. The National Assembly in Berlin was dissolved. In reply, its more radical members called for a tax strike, which Marx and the New Rhinish Gazette fully supported. In fact, Marx later went on trial in Cologne for this, but was acquitted. But things got worse, and in May 1849, the last issue of the daily paper appeared, printed in red. Marx went into exile, first in France, then in England, where, of course, he settled. Engels went on to fight on the barricades in southern Germany, so could have given his due, he wasn't just all talk. And when these were put down, he went to Switzerland and then to England. Now, first, Marx, Engels, and the other members of the Central Committee of the Communist League in exile in London refused to believe that it was all over. In fact, they thought that the bourgeois revolution would soon break out again in Germany, and still thought this could be immediately followed by a proletarian revolution. The March 1850 address advanced this view, arguing that once the working class had helped the bourgeoisie against feudalism and absolutism, they should refuse to hand over their arms. They should organise workers' councils in the working class districts, and socialists should encourage them to raise even more radical demands. Now, Marx and the Central Committee of the League called this policy of permanent revolution. And this, of course, is a phrase which Trotsky and the Trotskyists use. This is, in fact, where Trotsky got it from. The address was also a favourite of Lenin's for obvious reasons, as it appeared to provide some justification for its policy of socialists trying to win power in the course of a bourgeois revolution. In fact, we don't have to be mealy-moused about this and say it appeared to justify Lenin's policy. It didn't just appear to, it did justify it. But unfortunately, for Lenin, before the year 1850 was out, Marx realised that this assessment had been completely mistaken. The bourgeois revolution was not going to break out in the near future. That would have to wait for the next economic crisis, he said. It was merely romanticism for socialists to continue to think in terms of the working class winning power in the immediate future. This change of attitude on the part of Marx, Engels, and the majority the majority of the Central Committee of the Communist League led to a split in the organisation. The issue was precisely about whether or not a proletarian revolution was still on the cards. The minutes of the Central Committee meeting of the 15th of September 1850 refer to a discussion at a previous meeting on the position of the proletariat in the next revolution. and record the views of Marx and Karl Schäpper, one of the minority who disagreed with him, and the majority. According to the minutes, Marx argued, I'm quoting again here, "We are devoted to a party which would do best not to assume power just now. The proletariat, if it should come to power, would not be able to implement proletarian measures immediately, but would have to introduce petty bourgeois ones. Our party could only become a government when conditions allow its views to be put into practice." Louis Blanc provides the best example of what happens when power is assumed prematurely. This was Louis Blanc. This was in the course of the French events in 1848. It was a sort of mild social democratic government, which was eventually overthrown. Engels, in a long article written about the same time, later published as a separate pamphlet, The Peasant War in Germany, developed the same argument about what would happen in the event of a premature capture of power, even using the same example of Louis Blanc. This is what Engels wrote. "The worst thing that could befall a leader of an extreme party is to be compelled to take over a government when society is not yet ripe for the domination of the class he represents and for the measures which that domination implies. What he can do depends not on his will, but upon the level of development of the material means of existence or the conditions of production and commerce upon which class contradictions always repose. He is compelled to represent not his party or his class, but the class for whose domination the movement is then ripe." And Marx had already said the same thing in October 1847. This is the article I've quoted from before. Could hold it again. "If, therefore, the proletariat overthrows the political rule of the bourgeoisie, its victory will only be temporary, only an element in the service of the bourgeois revolution itself, as in the year 1794. As long as in the course of history, its movement, the material conditions have not yet been created, which make necessary the abolition of the bourgeois mode of production, and therefore also the definitive overthrow of the political rule of the bourgeoisie." Now, these two quotes were put to very good use by Mensheviks to criticize Lenin and the Bolsheviks and to develop a theory based on Marx's view as to what happened in Russia in 1917. I mean, they said that in 1917, a bourgeois revolution was taking place. In the course of it, the Bolsheviks seized power in the bid to promote a socialist revolution. However, since conditions were not ripe for a socialist revolution or for socialism, Bolshevik rule would merely be, in Marx's words, an element in the service of the bourgeois revolution itself. But the Bolsheviks certainly did live up to the terror in 1794. The Tsar and many of his supporters, the whole of his family, were executed or put in concentration camps, and the whole Tsarist social order was completely uprooted. But in the end, the Mensheviki, this was only going to be temporary, that once the Bolsheviks had done this, they would be taken, the bourgeoisie would come back. This didn't happen, of course, but I mean, even as late as 1929, the Mensheviks and some other social democrats expected that Bolshevik rule would be overthrown and replaced by that of the bourgeoisie. But in fact, it took another 80 years before that happened. Instead, what happened was that the Bolsheviks remained in power and evolved into a new ruling class themselves. What developed in Russia was not private capitalism after a more or less brief period of Bolshevik rule and terror against Tsarism, but a new form of capitalism under state ownership and control not seen before and which was not anticipated by Marx in the 19th century. Nevertheless, these two passages do provide the basis for an explanation as to why the Bolshevik Revolution, insofar as it was an attempt to move towards socialism, was bound to fail, and for why the Bolshevik leaders would end up as the servants, not the masters, of objective material conditions. What Marx and Engels were in effect saying was the conditions in 1848 and 1850 were not ripe for what Marx sometimes called the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, this was a phrase borrowed from French revolutionary socialists of the time, but to which Marx gave a more democratic content. In fact, in April 1850, the Communist League joined with some other French revolutionary socialists and left-wing chartists to form a secret international organization called the World Society of Revolutionary Communists. Its stated aim which Marx signed on behalf of the League, was, I'm quoting here, the overthrow of all privileged classes and their subjugation to the dictatorship of the proletariat, which will carry through the permanent revolution until the realization of communism, the ultimate form of organization of the human family. Marx, however, never understood dictatorship of the proletariat in the Leninist sense of a dictatorship exercised by a vanguard party claiming to represent the proletariat. Those, some of the other people that signed this this declaration, the French revolutionaries, did, even the followers of Blanqui. But its use was still ambiguous, not so much the word dictatorship, which had not yet acquired its modern sense, but meant something like full powers. The ambiguity was over who was to exercise these full powers. Who was the proletariat? If was meant, as Marx generally did, the working class in the sense of those who were forced to sell their labour power to live, this would have meant that the full powers would have been exercised by a minority only of the population, since the working class proper was at this time still only a minority class. I mean, most producers were either peasants or artisans working with their own instruments of production and tools, which Marx called the petty bourgeoisie. But in this would be a denial of democracy, Marx said he stood for, which in fact he really did stand for. If, on the other hand, the full powers were envisioned as being exercised by the people via their democratically elected representatives, as Marx did envisage, then this could only legitimately be called the dictatorship of the proletariat if the word proletariat was stretched to include the petty bourgeoisie and the peasantry, which was precisely one of the criticisms Marx had made of Schäpe in that debate in the Central Committee of the Communist League. This is a quote for the minutes. The word proletariat has been reduced to a mere phrase, like the word people was by the Democrats. To make this phrase a reality, one would have to declare the entire petty bourgeoisie to be proletarians, i.e. de facto represent the petty bourgeoisie and not the proletariat. So here again, what Marx was saying was the conditions weren't ripe for the rule of the proletariat, and that it would lead to the rule either by or on behalf of the petty bourgeoisie. He was in effect saying that in 1850, even the dictates of the proletariat as the beginning of a transition to socialism, let alone socialism itself, was not possible. Now, Engels' comments in 1895, so already mentioned, can serve as an epitaph to the illusions he and Marx had entertained in what might be called, inverted commas, the Leninist period of 1848-50, about an immediately following proletarian revolution. This is what Engels wrote. History has proved us and all who thought like us wrong. It is made clear that the state of economic development on the continent at that time was not, by a long way, ripe for the elimination of capitalist production. The time is past for revolutions carried through by small minorities at the head of uncontrolled masses. When it gets to be a matter of the complete transformation of the social organization, the masses themselves must participate, must understand what is at stake and why they are to act. That much the history of the last 50 years has taught us. But so that the masses may understand what is to be done, long and persistent work is required. So in conclusion, I can say that sometime between April and September 1850, Marx came to the conclusion that not only were conditions not ripe for a proletariat revolution at that time, but that precisely because of this, it was a mistake to try for one, since even if socialists were to come to power, they would not be able to serve the interests of the working class, nor to further the cause of socialism. All that they'd be able to do was to serve the interests of a section of the bourgeoisie and to further the development of capitalism. I mean, this represented a repudiation of his previous views, which were those Lenin latched onto to justify the Bolshevik seizure of power in 1917, and in fact represented a powerful and far-sighted criticism of it. So we can say, in answer to the question, was Marx a Leninist or was Marx ever a Leninist, is that he did flirt with Leninist-type ideas for a while, but then abandoned them, and always thereafter opposed them in favour of a long and protracted process of working-class self-organisation, which would eventually lead them to being ready to win political control and establish socialism. Okay, that's it.